Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and today, my friends, is January the 10th. It is Wednesday already, midweek, and we are already into 2018. If you are home today, recovering from an illness, maybe a surgery, or we just want to be letting you know we're thinking about you and praying for you. And there's so many people that got struck and smitten with this cold and flu virus. I know there's several people here in the office, including me, that struggled with it a little bit, but I'm feeling much snappier, so that's good. And if you had a little dose of the cold or flu, you have my complete sympathy, just so you know. This is no fun. All right, this is a story out of Redding, California that got my attention because, trust me, there are there are better ways to kill a spider than trying to light it on fire. All right, do you think this was done by a man or a woman? Tick, 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 tick. And the answer is a man. You're correct. A California man learned that lesson after causing $11,000 worth of damage to his apartment when he tried to use a torch lighter to dispose of a huge spider. The Redding Record searchlight says the man was successful in setting fire to the spider, but it crawled its way to a mattress, which was quickly engulfed in flames. Quiet, Bill. Firefighters arrived in time to keep the fire from spreading to other apartments. No one was hurt. No word on whether or not the spider survived. I'm guessing he didn't. Oh, that's painful. I used to live in Houston, Texas, where there were so many cockroaches in the kitchen that you thought, well, fire's one way to get rid of them. I want to say at one point I tried something like that. Not proud to admit that, but I can just say with confidence that apartment building I lived in, the lovely West Creek Apartments in Houston, is still standing. So I feel better knowing that I did not burn that place down. Anyway, it is 6 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break, and then Bill English is with us, already chuckling in studio. We'll be right back. It is 7 minutes after the hour. In studio is Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
I've already gotten a laugh out of you this morning. You thought that was an amusing story of a spider on fire racing to the mattress for its own life, and then it starts the mattress on fire.
I mean, how does that thought process go? I think I'll light a spider on fire.
This is guy brains. We should be able to figure this out between the two of us. You know?
Oh, my gosh, that was funny.
Yeah, it was. It was painful. Trust me.
Only to the spider, right?
Yeah, of course. So let's talk about top conversations we need to have if we're going to be a family business, and there's going to be three conversations that are going to be important to have. And at the end of this conversation, I want to bring into the equation the idea of learning how to dissent and do it well. Because every organization, every company, I think, would value from a dissenter. So let's talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
So let's start with some of the important conversations we need to have in a family business.
Yeah, this is from an article by Real Business out of the UK. The article is titled, Three Difficult Conversations Every Family Business Needs to Have. The first one is, how do you create boundaries between business and family time? And this reminded me of another article I was reading about this, where they were asking the question, to the matriarch or the patriarch of the business, are you raising a business family or are you growing a family business? Because the difference is profound.
I see the difference.
I work with a couple of family businesses right now where it's all about the business and family is completely secondary to whatever is happening in the business. I'm working with another business where the family and the business have appropriate, I'm going to say, distance or bifurcation, and both the business and the family are more healthy as a result.
I would imagine.
The second question that they ask is, how do we tackle succession planning?
Mm-hmm.
And succession planning is a difficult topic for business owners simply because they don't want to talk about death. They don't want to talk about retirement, you know, in other words, not being useful anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to talk about the end. They always want to keep going. And so succession planning is something that we think families need to focus on to find the right leader for their business, who's next in line, whether that next in line leader is family or non-family. And this is where your idea of dissenting can really come in, because the families need to have very open and honest conversation about what each family members want out of life, out of, for their own personal career, so to speak, what they want from the business, that kind of thing. And a lot of times during these family conversations, conflicts surface and people start to really understand that maybe we're not always on the same page.
Mm-hmm. All right. So these questions are important as families try to navigate their way through succession. And if you're doing it well, what I'm hearing you say, Bill, is you've got business being business. And then when the family's together, maybe for the holiday or a Sunday football game, they're not obsessed with talking about the business.
Yeah, one of the hallmarks that Platinum that we use to decide if the family is healthy is, can they sit down for Thanksgiving to get dinner together as a family? Can they have a good time at that dinner and not talk about the business?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, do they have appropriate balance between the family relationships and the business relationships? Look, the complexity here is difficult, and it often leads to clash points. But the complexity is, right now, during the day, at the job, I might be your brother, but I also might be your manager,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I'm the manager during the day, I'm your brother at night. Or I'm your father at night, but during the day, I'm your employer. And switching those hats, you know, going
yeah.
back and forth on the hats, really requires a lot of maturity on everybody's part. And it also can often lead to some significant clash points, because you'll have sons. The proverbial example is you'll have sons who will come in and yell at their dad in the business during the day and treat him like dad rather than treating him like an employer.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of things are not good.
So if you're my brother at Thanksgiving and I'm your boss, I'm your manager, I could basically tell you to go get me more mashed potatoes. But if you're my brother, you could say, get your own mashed potatoes.
That's right.
And that would be more healthy.
Yeah, get your own mashed potatoes.
Right. But when we show up at work on Monday, if I say, go get me more mashed potatoes, you might have to go get me more mashed potatoes.
You might. But you would hope that the brother in charge would have more maturity than that.
Yeah. Well, that we will find out if that's true or not. But
go light the spider on fire, right?
Right, right. So the families are needing to develop a vision about the business, and they need to bring their values, obviously, to the business, but they also need to figure out how to love each other. And, you know, maybe that's the job of the head of the household to say, as the leader of the pack here, when we get together for Thanksgiving, I'm not going to talk about business.
Yeah, and I'm not going to treat you like we're in the business, and we're not going to... We're going to be a family. We're going to talk about the hopes and dreams of the family members. Look, one of the hallmarks of a healthy family that also owns a business is that some family members can excel at pursuits outside of the business, and achievements in those areas are celebrated just as much as success within the business. So, for example, you might have one brother who decides that he wants to go work in the business and make that his career. You might have a daughter that decides to go on to law school and become a lawyer and becomes a partner in a law firm. Both are celebrated equally within the family. And so what happens in some of these enmeshed families when you're growing a business family as opposed to a family business, if you're doing the former, the business family, the daughter who goes and becomes a lawyer and becomes a partner, that's not celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
That's not valued.
Mm-hmm.
Because she really almost betrayed the family by leaving the family business and going on to do her own thing. And so healthy families celebrate success irrespective of whether it achieves in the business or outside the business.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk, Bill, about disagreeing with your boss. Let's figure out a way to make this seem healthy, because it seems if you're going to have a healthy organization, if you have a dissenter in the group,
right,
You know, if there's eight boys on top of the roof with an umbrella, and they say, "Hey, if we jump off and open this umbrella, we'll float to the ground." You know,
well, there's a difference between disagreement and just stupidity.
Well, I get that. I'm just using this as an example. And there's one kid in the group that says, "I don't think that's a good idea.
I don't think that's a good idea."
Right. Right. That boy needs to be listened to.
Yes, he does.
Even though the other seven boys are saying, "Oh, boy, you know, this is going to be fun. We're not going to get hurt."
Yeah.
And so how do we, I'm going to go to break right now, but how do we do this in business where we can be the dissenter and say, I'm not so sure that's a good idea. And then not be considered the outcast or the troublemaker or the person who's just disagreeable and cantankerous. There's a big word for the day. It's 15 minutes after the hour. I'll be back more with Bill English in just a minute. It's 17 minutes after the hour. I was reading an article of a gentleman who was sort of wishing he could disagree with his boss and was kind of feeling like maybe wanting to complain a little bit. So he sort of put some of these complaints and disagreements into an email to send to a coworker. He hit send and realized he sent it right to his boss. So he quickly raced over to her office with an oversized bouquet of flowers to apologize.
Didn't work, did it?
I don't think it worked. She was very kind to him and said, boy, next time you disagree with me, just tell me so we can talk about it. And her advice was very generous and very helpful. And it's important to be able to confront someone and to be able to disagree, because disagreements are inevitable. They're normal, and they're a healthy part of relating to each other. And if we think we're going to work in a conflict-free work environment, I think we're not. So we have to figure out how to do that and do it well. So yeah. With me in studio, of course, is Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. Mm-hmm. Bill, you must have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, when you need to disagree, whether it's laterally, up the ladder, down the ladder at work, that kind of thing, there's several parts of your message that you need to kind of map out and think about, and then you can be clear in your communication. The first thing I would suggest is that you state what you have observed. Here's what I have observed. This is what I've seen. This is verifiable evidence. Had the videotape been running without sound, this is what I would have
yeah.
seen, and this is what we all would have seen.
Okay,
right. And then the second thing is, this is what I felt. So I felt angry, I felt sad, I felt happy, I felt excited, you know, whatever the feelings were. Now, part of the problem here is that the third thing is you want to go, I shouldn't say part of the problem right now. The third thing is, this is what I think about what I observe, and this is how I felt. So here's what I observed, here's what I felt, and here's what my thoughts were.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people get the feelings and the thoughts mixed up. I feel that we should table this discussion until
mm-hmm.
later. That's not a feeling. That's a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I feel that you are not listening to me. No, nope, that's not a feeling. You might feel discounted. I feel discounted because I'm observing that you're not listening to me. Now, that's a more congruent message, right? And so when you can talk about your observations, your feelings, and your thoughts, and they're congruent, it's tougher for people to avoid you. It's tougher for people to discount what you're thinking and what you're feeling and what you're observing
mm-hmm.
because the three are congruent.
You know, Kent Kaiser, who's usually in on Wednesdays as well, who's in Arizona right now. So, Kent, if you're listening, I hope you're having a nice time. But he will always confront a student in his class. When the student starts a sentence with "I feel," Kent will instantly interrupt them and say, "You need to stop saying 'I feel' and replace it with 'I think.'"
I think.
Yeah, because when we're dealing with people's feelings, well, how do we do that at work? I mean, I know feelings at work are important, but how do we deal with that? I mean, lead with your thinking. Does that sound right?
It does.
Okay.
Lead with your thinking and lead with your observations. And then there's two other areas to lead with. One is your wants, and the other one is what you're going to do. So let me talk about the wants for just a moment. One of the most powerful statements that you can make is to learn about the other person's experience in these dissenting situations, and to learn what they want, and then state back to them that I want for you what you want.
Mm.
You know, so maybe you and I, Bill, are having a disagreement, and you want to have the corner office. Okay, let's
True.
Just say. Okay.
True.
And so, if I come to you and I say, look, Bill, I want you to have the corner office, that becomes a very powerful statement.
Mm-hmm.
So you state what you want for yourself, and you state what you want for others. But the way that you state what you want for others is to get to know them and get to crawl inside their head and their emotions to find out what they really want, what they really think, what they really feel. And then if you can genuinely support that, you state that back to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most powerful ways to lower the tension in an argument or in a disagreement. And then, talk about the do part. So this is what we've tried in the past. It worked, didn't work. This is what we're doing today. But I'm going to commit that I'm going to do this action or this other thing in the future in order to try to resolve this conflict or try to resolve this dissension. So you want to look at what you observe, what you feel, what you think, what you want for self and others, what you do, have done, are doing, and will do in the future.
Mm-hmm.
You do those five things, which is, when they are congruent, they become a very, very powerful message within business. And shameless plug here, this is what I do in a one-day seminar called Managing Difficult Business Conversations.
Awesome. All right, now, Bill, if we're always asking if there's a better approach, and maybe that's creating some friction, and sometimes that can be good creative friction.
Yeah.
Is there a new, better solution? But if we're always trying to ask our coworkers or our boss if there's a better way of doing things, will that come across as passive aggressive, or will that come across as you're really a forward thinker that wants to make things better? Or are they going to look at you and say, oh, you just got your personal agenda one more time, pushing for change?
You know, it depends on how you do it, because most of our communication is nonverbal. It's not verbal. And so I think it depends on the attitude that you say it in and the context in which it comes up. I think if you're saying, look, I'd just like to explore a couple of other ways to think about this, just to make sure we don't miss anything and we uncover every rock kind of thing, I think most people would go along with that.
Okay. It's always uncomfortable when somebody will challenge your ideas.
Because,
you know, and I wonder if it's even going to be more difficult for some of the millennials that are coming into the workforce who maybe got participation trophies after going 0-13, that when their idea comes to the surface and they're told, maybe not so much, they could be even more devastated by that.
You know, we don't know how to disagree in this country. You can so tailor your world now with technology that you never hear opposing viewpoints. You can tailor your world so that you never have to have a winner or a loser. We just don't do disagreements at all in this country. And one of the best things we could do is to learn how to disagree amiably without being, what's the phrase? Disagree without being disagreeable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think our country has lost that.
Do you think that when companies, employers, employees work through a conflict together, that they end up possibly not only liking each other better, but they're on track for a better work environment?
My short answer is yes. My longer answer is it's one of the undeniable truths of Christian business ownership, is you can't get any traction without some friction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to learn how to have disagreements, but do it in a way that is loving and kind. Truth without love becomes a very harsh ruling. Love without truth becomes this willy-nilly wet noodle thing that nothing ever really gets accomplished. You need a balance between truth, and you need a balance between love. And in management team meetings, I talk about the last 10%. So, Bill, you might appreciate this. What I talk about is it's easy to give the first 85 or 90% of a message. It's that last 10% where I know I'm going to tick them off, or
mm-hmm.
I know it's a really sensitive
yeah.
topic. And so at the end of every management team meeting that I lead, I go around and I say, have you given everybody the last 10%?
Ooh. So let me just in conclusion say, if you're not afraid to constructively disagree about issues at work, there's a chance you're going to be happier going to work.
And there's a chance that you will probably get promoted because most people don't handle conflict well. So those that do end up getting promoted because they're seen as leaders.
Yeah. All right. Bill English, thank you so much for coming in today. Have a great, great day.
And you too.
I will see you next week.
All right.
Yeah. It's 27 minutes after the hour. We'll take a break and then we're going to go to Breakpoint.
Couldn't sleep at all last night. Just thinking of you.
28 minutes until the top of the hour. That song makes me smile. We'll take a little break for news. And then 20 minutes until the top of the hour, we're going to speak to David Wheaton. I can't wait. Good morning. It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour. Owen Strand is a professor and author, and he talks about being of good cheer. He says that we only need to look to the cross to be reminded that any situation can be turned around for good.
You think about Jesus. You think about Jesus' death, and you just have to recognize it is the worst possible thing that has ever happened in the world. But in the divine irony of God's logic, it is also the best thing that has ever happened in the world. You look at the cross, and you just recognize that God can take anything and turn it to good, and not just good, a little good, a thimbleful of good, incredible good, the salvation of our souls, something that is the central fact of all human history. When I have a perspective that is shaped by realities like that, then I am equipped for my boss to get upset with me. I am ready for when my family has tensions. I am able to continue keeping the faith when there's tension in the church body. When I recognize that God can take anything in my life and turn it for good, all because of what happened to Jesus Christ, all because of what Christ went through, then I'm ready to go. I've got boots on my feet, and we're queued up for the valley of the shadow of death. We don't ask for it to come. We don't beg trials to hit us, but we just have to recognize we have a Christ-fired faith, and that means that trials do not bog us down, ultimately. Trials are not going to overcome us. Even if we're called to die, death is gain. This is Christianity. There's this incredible transfiguration of everything that hits us, and such that God can use it for his glory and our good.
That is Owen Strand, if you want to hear that interview. Strand is spelled S-T-R-A-C-H-A-N, so it's a little tricky. But go to MyFaithRadio.com and type in Owen Strand or type in Life Adventures, and you should get to that interview. It's a good one. We'll take a very short break and then return with my friend David Wheaton.
When your child's report card comes home, are you pleased or deflated? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. How do you respond when you're expecting A's and your kid brings home D's? When the day comes, keep these principles in mind. First, never step in to rescue your child. Doing their homework reinforces their failure. Second, if you notice a drastic and sudden decline in grades, look for a deeper cause. There may be something wrong, such as depression or drug abuse. And finally, if grades drop, don't overreact by punishing poor performance. Your child's value surpasses a report card. Stay on their team and be the mom and dad they desperately need.
Get a free online parenting course called Tough Guys and Drama Queens at freeparentingcourse.com.
And that music, of course, welcome to the program, David Wheaton. Author, radio host, and friend. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bill. How are you today?
I'm doing much better. I had a little bit of the cold and flu crud, but I'm feeling much better.
That's what I hear, and I know it's going around, so hopefully nothing gets transmitted down the microphone here today.
No. Don't. You're safe. You're safe.
Okay, good.
All right, let me talk about this. I find this fascinating. Stanley Hauerwas, he's a big-name philosopher. He teaches at Duke University. And, he's the cover of Time magazine, kind of big name. But he says that when students say to him, in class, they say, I think nobody can tell you what's right or wrong. You have to think for yourself. He loves that question. He loves it when students say you have to determine truth for yourself, because he says that, you know, every culture before our culture believed right or wrong was determined outside of ourself. It was determined by God.
Mm-hmm.
And every religion and culture is different, but right and wrong is determined by something outside of us, and it's our job to harmonize with it. We don't get to decide what's right and wrong. We're back to the Garden of Eden, aren't we?
Yeah, we are, and there's really two things that are in that statement when someone says, you know, well, this is my truth, or truth is relative to the person, and those types of comments. Number one, that's the ultimate in human reasoning, like you say, back to the garden where Eve does what's right in her own eyes instead of relying and basing her life on what someone external to her tells her. And so that's where humanity goes. It's the Tower of Babel, the ultimate rejection of what God says. That's one thing. But secondly, no one really lives like that. No one really lives like, well, my truth is the only truth that's important. When everyone comes up to a stoplight, you know, most everyone, 99.9%, stop because they don't want to get T-boned by a car and get killed. Mm-hmm. So the truth is you must stop at stop lines. You cannot murder someone or you'll go to jail. You can't live in this morally relativistic world, you say, because it really doesn't work out. So it's convenient for people to say that when it comes to especially moral issues, like sexuality, like things they make accountable for, make room for in their ethical life with their taxes or something else. But it really does. It's really not a worldview that can be based upon and lived by. No one really lives by what they actually say if they say that. If that makes sense.
It does. And Howard Wass said, he said, when an American says that you have to think and determine truth for yourself, he says that you're not thinking for yourself at all. You're adopting a way of thinking, which is a particular view of truth and spiritual reality.
That's exactly right. This is a very well-defined worldview. And by the way, this is the world's biggest problem with the biblical worldview, is that it gives exclusive truth. Jesus said in John 17:17, when he prayed to his Father, he said, sanctify them. He was talking about his disciples. Sanctify them in the truth, not a truth, not your truth. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. And this is what the world hates, or the unbelieving world, I should say, hates about biblical Christianity, is that Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. This is what's so offensive to the unbelieving world, because there's a definitive, exclusive truth claim to Christ, to Scripture, and this goes against what they don't want to be under that, and so they have to create other ways, other truths, so to speak, to get out from under the accountability of God. Now, if the Bible were much more, well, you can go to heaven this way, you can go to heaven this way, they'd have no problem with it at all. It's the exclusivity of Scripture, it's the exclusivity of Christ, where the huge obstacle is to people surrendering and coming to saving faith in Christ.
Well, David, all religions, the whole point of religion is exclusivity. I mean, if I went to Hinduism and said, look, I want to become a Hindu, but I don't believe in this reincarnation stuff, how would I be welcomed?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because you're right. All of the religions of the world have their own exclusive claims. Although I don't think any of them are as exclusive as biblical Christianity, you know, maybe Islam. But I think if you talk to religious people elsewhere, they don't quite have the same set of as biblical Christians do about what Christ said about him being the only way. I mean, he is the only way. It's incredibly exclusive. Yes, there's only one way. But thank God he did provide one way for us to be right with him. And by the way, it's incredibly inclusive as well. It's open to everyone mm-hmm. in the world, no matter where you're from, if you are willing to repent of your sin and believe in who Jesus is and what he did for you. So, but I don't think, you know, just from – this is anecdotal, but just from traveling over the years and so forth, just interacting with those and other religions in different parts of the world, they don't hold the same – they believe what they believe, and they're kind of sticking with it, but they don't – necessarily believe that Christians over in America aren't going to heaven. Well, that's what you believe. And I don't think they have the same exclusive belief that believers do, that biblical Christians do.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we look at John 14:6, David, and mm-hmm. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. So that's a truth that exists. And then it's my job to align myself to that truth claim or not.
That's exactly right.
I can't sit and create my own truth claim and say, hey, I'm thinking for myself. Look how smart I am.
Well, this is what I often think about when I read scripture and you read just about, let's say, one of the gospels about Christ. Let's say the Gospel of John. As you work your way through those chapters of John, what is it, 22 chapters of John, I think it is, you come across these incredible statements that Christ makes about himself. I'm equal with God. I'm the Son of God. I'm the only way to heaven. I and the Father are one. And then what others say about him, and then what he did in his deeds, heal people and so forth. And you take these and you think, I mean, what on earth? This is just outside the realm of what anyone's ever claimed about themselves. No one's ever claimed this or done these things. And it's actually just shocking if you haven't been accustomed to reading it. Sometimes when you read the Bible and hear the stories over and over again, pull yourself back a little bit and think, this is really, really unbelievable what the claims that Christ makes about himself, what the Bible says about Jesus, what he did. And you start to realize that the truth being presented, it's sort of it is binary. People don't like that word today. Well, you're into binary truth. You know, either it's right or it's wrong. But it is binary when it comes to Jesus Christ. Either he is who he says he is, the Savior of mankind and the Son of God, or he's a lunatic, or he's just crazy, or the Bible is completely wrong. There really is no room for middle ground when it comes to the word and when it comes to Jesus.
Mm-hmm. David, let me take a break. And this is a very long setup for what I'm going to ask you next, which is some of the comments that Oprah Winfrey made at the Golden Globes about seeking your truth. We'll be back in just a minute with David Wheaton. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Good morning, 11 minutes until the top of the hour. So glad you have joined in the conversation I'm having with my friend David Wheaton from the Christian Worldview radio program. David, very interesting. Oprah Winfrey made a comment in her rousing speech she gave at the Golden Globes, which got a lot of media attention. Everyone sort of jumped on that bandwagon as she spoke about her truth. I think Rebecca has a clip of that.
What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have.
Sounds like we're providing people with a broken toolbox.
Yeah, it's interesting what I know for sure. In other words, I'm about to say a truthful thing, an absolute, absolutely objective, truthful saying, your truth. So that means each one of us can have our own truth.
Yes.
You know, this is not surprising or anything new with Oprah Winfrey. And by the way, she's a very articulate, intelligent, successful, and I don't know her personally, but I'm sure she's probably a nice person. I have nothing against her from that perspective at all. But this is not new, this worldview. If listeners today just go to YouTube and just put in the search at YouTube, Jesus is not the only way. You know, you watch all the statements that Oprah has made over the years. I remember one in particular that there was a woman in her audience. They were talking about, I think, I can't remember the topic of the show, but it came down to the exclusivity of Christ, what we were just talking about in the last segment. And Oprah was very vehemently saying, no, Jesus is not the only way. What about all these other religions, people, the typical humanist, universalist, your truth type worldview? So she totally believes that. You know, she would profess to be, I think she would profess to be a Christian too. So if you're not discerning, this would be very confusing to you. You know, Oprah's a professing Christian, but you know, how would she say that Jesus isn't the only way? Well, because this is typical of really the spirit of the age. This is how Satan confuses those who profess Christ but don't really think he's the only way. I mean, how does that work? That's logically incompatible with what Christ said about himself. But this issue of your truth, she said it in regard to actually the whole Me Too situations that have arisen in the last year in this country, where women have been sexually assaulted or harassed in the workplace. And, you know, she was basically praising women for coming out. And that's absolutely a good thing. We want much less or none of that going on in our society. But, you know, she couched it in terms of your truth as if, you know, as if the women who experience these things, it's really up to their word over anyone else. Whatever they say is right according to what you want. And it was just a typical. I think it's very consistent with their worldview, Bill.
Mm-hmm. Now, I offer Oprah some grace when she talks about her own personal story because she came mm-hmm. from a very broken past.
Yep.
And if someone told you, David Wheaton, let's see, you're tall, athletic, coordinated, you have superb hand-eye coordination, you will never become a good tennis player. There's a part of you that goes, well, wait a minute, no, I get to tell my story, you know. So there was a certain history and path that she was on where she was basically told that she would never amount to anything. And now you look at her place of prominence in the world, and her truth, her story is pretty important, pretty powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, and people are talking about the possibility of her running for president.
I know.
In 2020. And, you know, I think I've heard many conservatives say, well, they hope that she runs because Donald Trump would really easily defeat her. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think she's a very, very popular figure in our society. And I think, you know, one thing that Trump has done by winning this past election is that I think he's opened the way up for people who, let's say, are just popular for the sake of being popular. You know, Trump was, he was a billionaire real estate developer, but he really became very popular when he was on a reality TV show.
Mm-hmm.
You're Fired, you know,
right?
With the boardroom there. And so I think that's opened the door in our country to maybe put more emphasis or too much emphasis, perhaps, on just the celebrity of someone, the popularity of someone. Because Oprah is immensely popular, highly respected in our society, no political experience, as Trump didn't have either. I think it's a real possibility that the Democrat Party is going to look for someone who can be on the same popularity, celebrity mm-hmm. level with Donald Trump when they run in 2020.
David, I do find it interesting that in 2016, the left was saying, you can't have a TV star be president. But now in 2018, they say, Oprah for president.
Yeah, well, you know how politics goes. It's about winning in politics, and because winning is about power, and you know that's a religion in and of itself is political power, political party, and so forth. So I would not be surprised at all if Oprah runs in the next election.
Mm-hmm. So, David, as we wrap up our time together, what kind of encouragement could you give listeners when they encounter someone whose defense to the gospel is, well, that might be good for you, but I'm more of an intellectual type. I like to think for myself.
Well, that's a tough one, I think, when you encounter someone like that, because you have to have a willing, surrendered heart to get under the authority of God and His Word. And if someone just continually rejects that, it's going to be difficult to sort of talk them into it. If they've decided in their mind, if they've made a willful decision that they don't want any of that. Again, that's the fundamental problem of mankind, is an unwillingness, basically, to get under the accountability of God. Even though everyone's accountable to God eventually someday, He gives us free will to be under His authority. And so that's difficult. But I would just say, you know, go to the gospel, not trying to convince them out of their non-exclusive worldview, their relativistic worldview, but go to the gospel. And what the word is powerful. There's supernatural power in the word.
Indeed.
And so when you talk to someone and you talk about the words of Christ, like the verse we were talking about earlier, and talk about who Jesus Christ is and what He did, these are the things that break down that hardness in the heart that rejects the absolute truth of God. So I guess that's where I would start.
David, you always fill my tank. Thank you so much. Blessings to you and your family. Always keeping your parents in my prayers. So thanks so much, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Well, God's blessings to you too, Bill, and thank you for praying for my folks as well.
You bet. It's 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a very short break and wrap up the big show. Well, that wraps up our program for today. Special thanks to David Wheaton and Matthew Sorens. We had a very interesting conversation with Bill English about learning to dissent. And if you want to hear that, you can go to myfaithradio.com and check out that podcast. Dissenting is pretty important in business and in conflict resolution. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to tell your boss, I think you've got that wrong, and look at it in this way? That would be a good thing to be able to do with your boss, and do it respectfully, of course. But if you have life circumstances today that are crushing, you know that you have God's strength behind you. We are praying for you here at Faith Radio, and thank you for listening, and I will see you in the morning. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.